He's got his earbuds in.
I do.
What are you listening to?
Children recite poetry and then he plays it during the day.
It's the new King Cruel album. New album Fridays.
How we get started?
Put it on red, and then when we want to talk, turn it on. That way we can make comments about it.
Sure, it needs a microphone.
Here on a Friday afternoon. Sorry for those who need to work here last time. I didn't have to say on a Friday afternoon.
That's okay. Anyway,
we are starting our session meeting on the Little Lives program update. We're going to start with a welcome from Councilor Blum, who is our liaison from the council's office as far as project, and just going to say a few words, and then we'll give you some status update of the project, and we're going to hear.
I'll sit next to Ron. It's on.
There's a button on the bottom that you hit. That one.
Blinking? Maybe? I'll sit next to Ron. It'll be like the good old days on the Planning Commission. Thank you, everyone, for being here. Beautiful sun. I think the first sunny, clear Friday afternoon of the year. There's a place that I would rather be than talking about mobile lands models, but I know that some of you may have lives and may have other places that you'd like to be. So I thank you for your dedication and your commitment to be here. We had an update from the staff and from the team that we're working with, the council did, and we are supportive of the process that you've all put forward to go forward. We are looking forward to seeing the work that this group comes forward. This truly is building the foundation of our comprehensive plan. And as many of you are involved in building in the construction industry, if you don't have a good foundation, you're not going to have a good structure, a good building, a good home, a good office space when you're done. So appreciate the effort that you are all here giving us, put into the foundation, and look forward to seeing the work that comes out of here. Thank you again for being here. Look forward to your productive time.
Thank you, John. So, as Council Bluff said, we had a meeting with Council January 29th to kind of go over with them what we laid out for you all back in December. There were a couple of items. One item that was added dealing with rural lands, and then we expanded a couple of items. So I'm going to let the consultant go over that in more detail. Sort of the feedback we got from the council, they just wanted to make sure that they were aware of the discussion and discourse. They're really looking forward to that, and they want that information. A recommendation, they want that to be available to them. So we're going to do that. There's another group that is going to be dealing with housing options, that there's another consultant going to be on board, and so where we can dovetail the work that they're going to be doing with this project, probably at the end, when we're doing reasonable measures, probably where that fit in, but we'll keep you posted on that if there's any changes to this going forward. That was the majority of the sort of comments from council. Also, the CREDC work that's being done for commercial industrial employment. They're doing a study on that, and so Councilor Olson brought that up and following up with Mike Beaumont and Court and CWC to see how that could fit into this project. So we'll have that also as part of this. And with that, I'll turn it over to the
Thank you, Jose. Give you a little preview of what we're doing this afternoon and what to expect moving forward. This is a list of the topics that we'll be bringing to the Billboard Pack. And I just want to go over them quickly to remind you how we can lay this out. First one is land classification. We're going to talk about that this afternoon. And this is a criteria to determine whether land is vacant or utilized. And it fits into the population capacity and many other elements and models, so it's pretty foundational. The second one is accounting for redevelopment. Assumptions to project for redevelopment. This is an issue that's talked about in the billboard and program guidelines. Third is modeling mixed use areas. That was an issue that we had some discussion about at the December meeting. Assumptions applied to areas designated for mixed use, how to model deal with those specific commercial areas that allow residential development. The third or fourth one is infrastructure gaps, gaps in transportation, water, sewer, stormwater that may preclude development during planning horizon, and looking at what's required for the new legislation. The fifth is market factor, ensuring county market factor assumptions are adequately justified. And again, there's guidance in the new guidebook about that. Basically says show your work and provide some advice about how to look at that, as well as saying that possibly using different market factor assumptions for different locations might be appropriate. Next one is capacity on rural lands, approach to estimating capacity on land outside the urban growth areas. This one was added due to comments that we received. Next one is infrastructure set aside, the amount of land that's going to be dedicated to streets and water facilities. Again, this is related to the legislation. We've also had a couple of comments about constraints and how constraints fit into the model and how much development is occurring on the land that may be identified as critical areas in the model. And so we'll also be looking at that in the context of infrastructure set aside, population capacity. The determination of how much housing and population ultimately that can be reflected. Again, employment density assumptions for job density and commercial industrial land development. And finally, data collection methods or data sources. So that is the agenda that we'll be going through over the coming months. And the next slide is our meeting schedule. So in December, we went over the project and identified the preliminary list of issues to be addressed within this process. Today, we're going to talk about identifying land suitable for development, introduce our analysis around land classifications, redevelopment, and maybe there's mixed use. And March, we'll begin to talk about land suitable for development, basically a follow-up discussion on this. There's a lot here that we're going to be going through this afternoon, market factor. And then in May, we'll wrap this up and have a set of preliminary recommendations. So you see in the slide, there's a few bold areas, one in May and another one in August, where we're looking at recommendations. Those are places where we'll wrap up pack discussions and reports instead of recommendations to take forward. Questions?
Ms. Song? Okay, my question is, I'm the one that last time brought up the rural lands. I guess I'm a little mystified. Will rural land be included in item 4?
Yes.
You show up as an item 5 topic, but I assume that you'll be looking at rural lands in your preliminary recommendations.
two sets of preliminary recommendations. We just broke it up into a set of topics that relate to identifying the land that's suitable for development and a set that's focused on capacity. Things might shift around. Those are a little bit arbitrary bins, but just sort of thinking about how the model works of what land is developable and then what is the capacity of that land. Rural land is right now shown to be grouped with the land capacity topic, so it would come to preliminary recommendations in August, but it would be addressed. It would come to preliminary recommendations, just not in the same time as the other.
I just have one quick question. I just want to make sure I heard you right, because it was a little bit different up there. Critical deductions will be looked at as one of the issues going forward?
Yeah, you can submit a testimony.
So I was just
critical areas, and we think that fits in the intersection between the intersection between infrastructure set asides and population capacity. So we'll bring some analysis to you with that juncture. Okay.
Just a logistical point on the schedule. The 9/18 date is when the trend and replacement activity will be ongoing, and so we might reconsider that last meeting time.
Okay, a little bit on committee protocols here. And just as a reminder, the way that we set up the protocols for this committee is around quorum and decision making. So half the appointed members need to be present for us to have official recommendations. And at least 2/3 of those present must agree on an order for us to identify an official recommendation. As we discussed in the first meeting, we'll strive for consensus as we work through this, and we'll do our best to record the different perspectives around the table as they are introduced. I also appreciate people turning in name tags on the side as the one in the comments that helps us facilitate the conversation. Jose is going to talk a little bit about testimony and media documentation moving forward.
Thanks, Bob. So on our webpage, my name and email is on there as project manager. If anyone has comments that they want the committee to consider, they should be directed to me directly, and I will share those with the committee. We try to get whatever comments we get between meetings to the committee members at least a week before the next meeting. So the more timely the comments and the more concise and on topic, the better for everyone's time. So just letting everyone know that. Again, members, there's no restriction on you communicating with council decision makers, but if you do, you're doing that as an individual. We want the committee to make the recommendations and have that go through that process. So just talk it for yourself if you're communicating with council members. That's all we wanted to be clear about. In terms of documentation, we need, once we get this recording thing worked out, that's going to be one of the sources we have for that. We are going to provide summaries, not minutes of meetings. Just going to have the capacity to do that. And the recording and the discourse, we want to document and be able to have that, but we're not going to have the minutes or transcripts of the meetings. And again, once we work out the bugs with the recording, I guess the microphones will charge overnight after their use, so that's why they're not functioning appropriately today.
All right, next agenda item is meeting one summary. And as I mentioned, these are going to be meeting notes, not minutes. There should be a copy in your packet if you don't have one. There's copies over on the table over there. So at this point, I would entertain any comments or corrections to the meeting summary for the December meeting.
I've got one small correction. Put it up. I think the desire for accuracy, which is my comment, just that there was a couple parts of that I don't think were quite clear that would need to be, and that's rather than saying City of Vancouver estimates, I would suggest that City of Vancouver comparisons of actual growth with BBLM reports.
Sorry,
two.
They're
not numbered here. It's, I guess, it's the second page, and it's the third from bottom. Bullet desire for accuracy. And then last sentence, City of Vancouver instead of estimates, just comparisons of actual growth and BBLM reports. Don't need to be retentive, just want to be clear. I think everyone in this room knew what I was saying, but this thing goes further, so I'm just going to clarify that.
Other comments, clarifications?
I just see this question about Yakult. My understanding is Yakult wants to develop a sewer system, and they're looking for funding for that. So it doesn't seem to me logical that you exclude that possibility of that development that would then allow Yakult to expand. So. I don't think the fact that they don't have one now is a good reason to exclude them.
Can you point me to where you like that?
Well, this is under, on the first page, your first question, the question about Yakult, why not include it?
Okay. So you would like to expand on that point, that the reason that you think they should be included is because they are looking for funding for students.
Yes.
Any additional questions or comments? So seeing none.
Move to approve as amended.
Okay. That was a motion. Give me 1 second.
Second.
Okay. Say that Stephen seconded. Just want to make a motion. Any further discussion at this point? All in favor, aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. All right, the next part of this, we're going to move into the technical analysis that we conducted, and there should be more down to the information in the demo in your packet. And we're going to start with an overview of the local lands model for the operation of office. We have to turn this over to Bob at this point.
So my responsibility for this project so far has been to help provide the data and information to the consultants to help run through their analysis. And so I'm going to kind of go through how the model currently works and why we want this. So the first thing we want to do is assign a development. We want to classify our land so that we can then step through these deductions and calculations to get to our forecast. And the land classifications matter because they decide what factors are applied to the vacant land, whatever what is vacant, in terms of realizing how much yield we're going to get out or how much capacity is remaining. It's really important that we group the land into categories so that we can apply these planning assumptions. So it's really a pretty simple system at this point because we're really just looking at the vacant, underutilized, and built classifications. And we often talk about it in terms of what's in play and out of play, or what's in the model and out of the model. The built classification has a lot of different names as we pulled out different pieces and excluded them for different reasons. As we've worked with the consultants, they've identified some of the odd language that we might have, and we've actually looked into the built bin and pulled out some more data that we wanted to look at a little bit closer. And you can see some of that where we pulled the excluded out as its own classification, so you can see what's excluded. We pulled out the lots less than 5,000 to take a look at those. But generally, we had that built classification, and then we talk about mansions and condos. That's when the consultants go, what's that? And that's really just the built classifications that are greater than an acre. Right? Those ones are greater than an acre, and they're built. We've always called them mansions and condos, going all the way back to 94. So one of the cool things about going through this is as we move along, we're always getting better software, better tools to look at the data. Different working with ECO, we've looked at different ways to model the data and look at it. And I think this is one of the neatest things we've done is found a way to kind of put all the, this is a point for every parcel in the Vancouver UGA, put on a graph, and the axis of the graph, the y-axis is the property size, and the x-axis is the building value per acre. So if you look at the upper left quadrant here, these are the large parcels with very little building value. You kind of say they're highly desirable for development. Over here we have very small lots with really high building value, and these areas are less likely to develop. This is kind of the basis of our unutilized classification. And you can see these purple ones are those ones that we say are mansions and condos. They're greater than an acre, and they have a lot of building value on them. So this is just a really cool way to look at it. And then we can start putting our classifications on this chart. And you can see here's the classification rate for vacant. It's right here next to zero because the classification is $13,000 worth of building value. That's what makes you vacant or not. We also have lots less than 5,000 are considered excluded. And one of the things we've noticed is all the developable land, right, your platted vacant land is down here towards 0, 0. It's less than 5,000 square feet and it's vacant. So there's a lot of stuff piled up down there in that corner. So we take this and zoom in a little bit and look at the underutilized classifications as well. You can see there's this 1 acre cutoff. So you see up here, this is our underutilized. Down here, we're calling everything under an acre built. And then we also have what we call the building value per acre cutoff, which is the bottom 10th percentile. If you were to put a histogram up here of all these points, the bottom 10th percentile is our cutoff. And that changes every year. Right now, it's at 544,000. So everything on this side is underutilized. Everything on this side is our mansions and condo exclusions. So this is, to me, I just think this is the coolest graph in the world that I can show 40,000 points on one graph and really get a visualization of what our classification scheme looks like. It's not just a bunch of bullet points. And we can also then, other ways of looking at this is turn over, switch it on to which one's converted. So,
Bob, what, when you say a lot of that stuff is down in that apex, what of a percentage basis?
That's a good question. And we've looked at that several ways. One way to look at it is acreage.
Yeah.
Another way to look at it is how many units does it generate? And so when you say, and we've looked at it also, is it the percentage of all built? Is it the percentage of the vacant? We've kind of looked at this every which way we can, and I think we're still looking at this data and trying to come up with answers to those questions. What do you mean by percentage and what does it look like? I think one of the things that's really been fascinating about this working with ECO is to get a different set of eyes on this data, because I've been looking at it for 27 years and have my own perspective, and they're like, I don't look at it like this, and, oh, that's interesting. At the same time, they're digesting all the stuff I'm throwing at them, and they're like, oh, that's an interesting way to look at this too. And we've been working really hard over the last month to get the data set together, understand it, and present here. And I say, we're finding a lot of interesting stuff, and I wish we had more time to work on it. But the meeting's today, so here we are. And that's kind of what we've done today, I think, is looking at some of the trend we've looked at and listening to you guys really want to look further at some of this stuff. And how do we do that? And can we do another iteration of our data model that we put together? So I'm looking at the analysis. So that's kind of the 2019 vacant lands model I showed you on the graph. But more looking at the analysis, we want to look at starting with 2007, which was the last big UGA change, to 2019, what's happened? What's converted? And what are the trends in that space? So we kind of the notion of comparing the 2007 data to 2019 and wading through that stuff. And we found a lot of interesting stuff in there, like there were 5 years with very little development in that time frame, which is kind of weird. And so that impact some of the results. The other thing we looked at is every time I've looked at comparing what was it and what did it convert to, I've always looked at stuff that we said was vacant, underutilized, and what happened to it. This time we said, no, we want to look at everything. So we switched and looked at the assessor's database and said, which parcels have had residential units added to them? And for commercial industrial, we said, which ones have added new buildings with a new year built? So that gets us, because we used to say that it was built, and it's still built, nothing changed from the BDI perspective, but it was built and rebuilt more, we ignored that. So this says, oh, you were built and you built more? That's interesting, let's look at stuff that's built and what we said was built, get it redeveloped, kind of get it back. The other thing we started to look at when you talk about percentages is, well, it's not really fair to say that the stuff that's underutilized, that's in urban holding, could have developed, because it's not really applied. And that's the same if you're not in the city of Vancouver, or other UGAs, if you're outside city limits and inside the UGA, you're really not in play. So we look at trying to take that out. And our first iteration through the data set, we did not have the urban holding in there, but we did have the UGA, so we were able to take the UGAs out, but the Vancouver urban holding remained. Yeah, another iteration would be awesome. But we've got really good results. I think one of the things looking at this data, it's kind of like looking at an aerial photo. You know, if you look at it from far enough out, it looks great. As you zoom in, it starts to pixelate. And I think some of this looks really good for trends. If you zoom in, you're going to find some oddities in the data. And I think when you say we're going to look at 2,000 parcel data and compare it to 2019 BBLM, the complexities of that are really confusing. Because it's a many-to-many relationship. To develop a plat, you'd have perhaps two or three parcels going into a plat, and coming out, you have 25 new parcels. So you have many going in and many coming out. The ones going in, a partial that can still remain with the original house on it, but it's just a smaller lot now. So really a complicated analysis, and it's been really fun to dig through the data. And I think Eco said, you know, one thing we found as we looked at the data is there's some situations where what we did was we took the 2007 data and just made a single point for each parcel and overlaid that on a development layer, because that didn't give us multiple records for each 2007 data. But then you say when you lay that on there, where's that point falling? And if it misses something and doesn't give a good result, is it skewed? And we could find an interesting situation where, no. The best example is the Green Mountain Golf Course. That is a very, it's like four parcels, and it turned into like five or six plats. And we took a point that was the middle of that and laid it on this development. It landed in the remainder piece, and so there was no development on that point. So we said, that's weird, and that's an oddity, but we still think the results are very good. And there's still some other stuff in the data, but again, for the trends we're going now, I think the data is such really good and really exciting to look at. It's been wonderful. And I think with that, we're going to go over some of the topics and discussions that we found.
Any additional questions for Bob? I'm going to turn it over to Becky, and she's going to take us through topics for discussion.
Okay, thanks. So this is what's on the docket for today. When we dug into land classifications and redevelopment, these are really the things that jumped out to us as the things we wanted the PAC to weigh in on and that we dug into in the analysis. So we looked, and Bob has hinted at some of these already. So for residential, we looked at the threshold of how large a lot has to be put into the vacant category. And how the model is treating platted lots that are not yet developed, but they are part of an approved subdivision. We also looked at the cutoffs that distinguish between vacant and underutilized land, so the building value that's used to differentiate between these. And then on underutilized land, there's a lower limit to the lot size that Bob mentioned. So what happens to things that are under that threshold? Are there some that should be considered underutilized, or is that working? And then on commercial and industrial, again, kind of looking at the thresholds that are used to put things in the category of vacant or underutilized. Are those thresholds, do they make sense? Do they need to be updated? Do we need to make some changes? And then also because the current methodology has some assumptions that a certain percentage, 5% of the population employment will get accommodated through redevelopment, and that happens outside of the model. It's not allocated to specific places. It just is 5% off the top. Looked at that and said, how does that relate to the work that we're doing, looking at land classifications? And as we think about redevelopment, we need to think about these two pieces, both the specific land that might redevelop and then assumptions more broadly about how much the land is redeveloping.
So that's what we're going to step through today. The way we're going to take this discussion is I'll step through what we've looked at on residential, and then we'll have discussion and questions on the residential, and then the commercial, step through what we looked at, take your discussion and questions, and then the off-model redevelopment. Any questions at a high level before we jump in on residential? So the first topic is lot size thresholds. The way that it's working right now is any lot that is under 5,000 square feet is considered built whether it has a house on it or not. So if you plot a subdivision and that subdivision has lots that are 4,900 square feet, all of those lots are now built even though they don't have a unit on them. Although that land is committed in a sense, it's platted, it's no longer vacant land available to somebody who's at the subdivider stage. It doesn't have a unit on it. It doesn't have population on it yet. So in terms of thinking about the population forecast, that is still future population that will be on that lot. So we need to kind of sync that up with recognizing that until there's a unit on it, it's part of your forecast, not part of your past development. And then the other side of this is that the platted lots that are, say, 6,000 square feet are being treated the same as a 40-acre lot that's not been subdivided yet. So things like road assumptions, infrastructure deductions, all that sort of thing, it's treating a 6,000 square foot lot the same as a 40-acre lot, and that doesn't really make sense. It's not really how it works. So in looking at this, we took the data set that Bob described, and we looked at this question of, you know, are the lots that are less than 5,000 square feet, are they less likely to develop? Are they unbuildable? We know that many jurisdictions are approving subdivisions of smaller lots now. It's allowed even in places. And so is there a reason to think that those lots wouldn't develop just because they're 2,000 square feet or 3,000 square feet? And so when we looked at this, the pattern that we see is that there's not really a big break. I mean, there is a little bit of a difference, but it's kind of in the level of noise, not a clear trend, down to about 1,000 square feet. Below 1,000 square feet, there's you know, a couple of sort of fragment lots down there don't actually seem to be building. But everything above 1,000 square feet looks like it's building. And so I think that said to us, okay, you know, if these lots are being platted and approved by cities and they're, you know, under 5,000 square feet, we should just treat them as a platted lot the same as we would if they were 6,000 square feet. So the initial recommendation from the project team is to create a new classification within the residential lands and take all the lots that are platted within some period of time recently, if they're part of an approved subdivision and they're not, you know, like from 50 years ago or something, that all of those would get grouped together, whether they're 2,000 square feet, 6,000 square feet, 8,000 square feet. They're part of an approved subdivision and under, let's say, an acre. That those would all be grouped together, so you could apply just a one unit per lot kind of an assumption. That's the most likely thing that's going to happen. You're not taking out other things. You're not applying the density. You're just assuming those are already platted. The density is pretty well set. That those should be treated as just their own category. And then the sort of raw vacant land would still get the deductions for roads and everything else, the gross to net deductions and density assumptions. I'm going to keep rolling through this. If anybody has questions that are preventing them from focusing on the next topic, you can raise them. But otherwise, I'll roll through this and we'll take your questions after we have all the residential. So the next piece is the building value threshold for vacant land. Because the two things that land have to be in order to fall into the vacant category right now are bigger than 5,000 square feet and building value less than 13,000. The issue with this is that threshold was set in 2000 and it's not been updated since then. And it doesn't vary by parcel size. This is, you know, it sort of conceptually could be an issue, right? Over time, there's inflation, building values, you know, what was $13,000 in 2000? It's not $13,000 anymore. So this threshold might, over time, become less appropriate. We just took a look at a lot of different ways that you could refine how you identify what land is vacant and what land is sort of developed, but also underutilized. There's a lot of that information in your memo. Ultimately, there are a lot of other ways that you can look at this. I've talked about how many different ways we tried sort of slicing and teasing things out of this. But a lot of that just is a lot more complicated. And so we had sort of a basic question of, is it worth it? Is doing a different and more complicated approach worth it? Does it really do a significantly better job? So the preliminary recommendation right now is to just use a simpler solution, to use building value per acre, because it does account for larger lots, and to assign it as a percentile, which is consistent with how the underutilized works. That provides consistency. It automatically adjusts over time. So that's the initial recommendation there. Again, I'll pause and see if anybody has burning questions before I go on. Yeah.
I guess I just said.
Go ahead.
I mean, I get sometimes you need to make the trade-offs between simplicity and accuracy. It sounds like you're thinking that it would be more accurate if you did some level of scaling, in that for bigger parcels you treated them a little bit differently than smaller ones. And so I just wanted some sense of, one, how complex that would be. That doesn't sound that complex, but let us know. And also just if, at least in our perspective, the overall model is missing a lot of growth. At least that's our perspective from the data. I would argue for being more aggressive on accuracy, even if you have to push a little bit on simplicity.
So at the risk of challenging the concept that there are no student questions, when I switched to looking at buildable, value of a building on a piece of property versus the building value per acre, the BVA, I looked at that a number of different times. I really don't get the concept, so I'm just wondering if you could be a little more clear with me on it, because I'm not quite sure exactly how you're going to make the transition between having an actual structure that has some sort of, assessor value versus picking what that might be. And I saw you use different numbers.
Thank you. Okay. So I'm going to let Bob Poole jump in if he has any corrections or clarifications here. But so to give an example, you have you have two lots. One is 10 acres and one is 1 acre, because I'm not going to do math on the fly. That's hard. So on your 10-acre lot, you have a building that is worth $100,000. It's a, I don't know what, but it's $100,000 on a 10-acre parcel. On your 1 acre parcel, you have a building that is $10,000. Right now, the $10,000 building on the 1 acre parcel would be considered vacant. The $100,000 building on the 10-acre parcel would be considered underutilized.
Got it. And so
if you were to switch to building value per acre, they would have the same building value per acre.
Understood.
I think I've done my math right there. And then both of them would end up in the same category,
which,
wherever you set that threshold.
Perfect. Thank you. That was a great example.
That approach effectively normalizes across
parcels. And then you still have to deal with what your BVA will equal, right?
Yes. You still have to set an appropriate threshold that gives it, you...
Whether it's 10,000 per acre or 20 or 30 is a issue for the model.
And Brian, I think we'll pick up on your comment maybe when we get to the discussion, if that's okay with you.
I don't know about this microphone having to run around all every corner. We could just work on the audio next time. So the question I have is really, as we go towards this simplistic blending between size and value, I'm wondering how are we going to take into account the concept of underutilized then? Is there going to be a different set of rules concerning underutilized? Because I think as we get especially into the urban area where zonings change and so forth, you can have a dwelling that's working just fine as a single family occupancy, but the opportunities are greater there, but it's meeting all the criteria as just being filled. But the demand or the pressure to develop to a much greater degree is obviously there. And I'm not opposed to this. I think it's overdue in the concept of how we're going to get to whether it's built or not built, but I think the underutilized question becomes much bigger for us then.
And I think that that goes to our next subject, which is the smaller properties that are right now too small to be considered underutilized. I think I will go ahead and step to that, and then we'll come back to sort of a discussion about how all this fits together. What you're talking about, I think, falls into this category for the most part. You've got a property, it's under an acre, it may be domed to allow 10 units on it. It has one. Do we assume it has capacity? Do we assume it doesn't have capacity? How do we decide? Because right now the model says if it is under an acre, it's by definition built. If it exceeds that vacant threshold, if it's got more than $13,000 worth of a building on it, it's built. Doesn't matter if that thing is worth $15,000 and it's an acre, and it doesn't matter if it's zoned for multifamily, doesn't matter, it's built. So the question was, how is this land behaving? What are we seeing as we look back with the data that Bob will be able to put together for us? What do we see looking back at what's happened on these parcels? And what we see is that the smaller ones that are under half an acre, vast majority of those don't go anywhere at all. Most of them stay. That's not too surprising, right? Most half-acre lots with a house on them don't change, even if they could. But we did see that in the half-acre to one-acre size, it's still a pretty small amount of land that did convert. But if you're converting to multifamily, that those units add up pretty quick, even if the acres are small. So we thought, well, maybe that's worth looking into, that kind of half-acre to one-acre size might have a unit on it. Most of them, I think, had a unit. Some of them had something else. And so we tried looking at, okay, does the building value matter for these? When we look at just that half-acre to one-acre size, does the building value help us see where there's potential? It does a little bit. So I think it's one where we thought, we might need to look at this a little bit more closely, but it does look like maybe that half acre to one acre band is worth considering, but most of it doesn't change. So there's sort of a spectrum, right? There's vacant where you expect most things to develop, and to the extent it doesn't, that's your market factor. There's underutilized where you think like some of this is going to develop, but no, it's not, because it's got something on it. And then there's down into your kind of smaller infill redevelopment potential where most of it's not going to change, but some of it will. And so how do you try to dial in how much of it will change and where? And I'll get to you in just a second. And so the initial recommendation here was to establish a new classification that would pick up those small lots between the half acre and 1 acre size, and then maybe try to bring in factors like how much additional capacity does it have under zoning? Is it zoned for multifamily? Could you, if you were tore down that house, could you get one additional or could you get 15 additional? So that category, even with that refinement on it, would still, you'd still need to think hard about what percentage of that land do you expect to convert over time so that you didn't overestimate capacity. But the initial recommendation was at least grab it and sort of put it into the bucket of stuff that you're assuming might have some capacity. And Eric?
Yeah, just real quick, I can talk about some of my comments we needed for recording. We do a lot of performance on projects, and we'll have people call our office quite a bit saying, I'd like to split this lot into two or four lots. And what you find is truly based on the zone. And the economy of scale are trying to do like a small short flat, two to four lots, hardly ever is cost effective. The only time you ever do it is when it's not really a monetary thing, it's not to make money or get lots. You're doing it because you want to
give it to your kids or something. And normally our site, I don't know, you're better off buying four lots in the development. But they want to stay where they're at. So it really depends on this multiple factors. I mean, like the zoning capacity, there's probably a cutoff where it's probably around six lots. So if you're getting under six lots out of that, it probably doesn't make sense to go through the process, especially with building and have improvements. So.
I just wanted to echo Eric's concern and statement. I absolutely 100% agree. I do think some additional digging on the zoning and what that breakpoint is, because to the point of, you know, something zoned at 15 and you could put 15 units on an acre parcel, that can skew the numbers pretty dramatically and also have more likely that that will be something than versus, you know, something that may allow additional unit or two on it. Just practically speaking, for the reasons Eric already.
We wanted to, you guys have already started us down this, so thank you. But we wanted to get your feedback on these ideas. So it's three preliminary recommendations on the table. Establishing a classification to pick up platted lots that include ones under 5,000 square feet as well as ones over 5,000 square feet that are part of approved subdivisions. For the vacant land, convert to a building value per acre threshold instead of building value. And for the underutilized residential land, to create a category that's that half acre to 1 acre, to use some sort of capacity cutoff to pick up the ones that have more capacity and to have a classification for those so that some capacity can be assigned to them. Those are the three ideas that we're bringing to you, and we want to know which ones you think, great, that makes sense, let's move on. Which ones do you want more information about to decide if you think that's the right path, and what additional information you would like to have.
David. Thank you. So I just have some questions as to what we're actually thinking about here. So the first question I have is, when you're talking about the when you're talking about the 5,000 square foot lots, are we talking about those actually being vacant? Is that the concept, is they're actually vacant?
Yeah.
Okay. So if they're actually considered to be vacant, are we also trying to put into the model things like cottage homes, ADUs, those kinds of things? Would that fall into that category, or would it fall into any of these that you're discussing for residential? Would it fall into the last one where you're talking about cutoffs for capacity? Because now both the county and the city of Vancouver, anyway, have ordinances that allow for multiple developments on single lots or more capacity on smaller lots given cottage homes and those setups. I don't know how those concepts play into this model in any way. And I read the ordinances and I didn't see how they dovetailed in. So that was my first question. The other one was, are we looking at voting on now what the BVA is? At all. Okay. So that's just a concept. If we use BVA, then the question is, at some later time, we have to decide what that value is. Okay.
So we're not necessarily asking for decisions today. We're looking for guidance. If you get to a point on one of these where everybody's in consensus, and we can put a marker down on that, but we'll come back in a couple of meetings and ask you for formal
recommendations
on this. Steve?
Yeah, I had another question about the
less than 5,000 square foot lot size. And I know we're looking to simplify things, but is the assumption that these are not contiguous? In other words, that you have a 5,000 square foot lot that doesn't have another one next to it? Because if you have two or more that were to combine through a transaction, then they could theoretically become available for building. And wouldn't that make your estimates inaccurate in terms of what becomes available? And is there a simple way of accounting for that in the model?
I would say, and other folks feel free to jump in on this, but I would say what we're looking for are lots that have been platted recently enough that we're not talking about something that was like three left behind lots from a 1960s subdivision that maybe you would consolidate them and replat them or put something else on them. Maybe sort of zone differently now.
Yeah.
We're talking about things that are platted recently enough that they're probably platted in a way that's consistent with the current zoning. It might be possible to consolidate and replat a batch of them, but if you just platted them within the last decade or so, probably not that likely to do that. And so even if you did, the odds that you would get a lot more than one unit for those things are not that high. So I think we're talking about things where the odds are the very most likely thing that will happen is somebody will build a house on that lot. And that the home builder just hasn't got there yet. So it's been platted, the home builder hasn't built the house yet. Those are the ones we're talking about. And if they're recently enough platted, so it's possible that those things could happen, but I think those fall into the category of you're never going to catch everything.
Yeah.
And so you try to pick the thing that is most likely that's going to happen most of the time. And if the exceptions are pretty rare.
Well, I asked the question because the definition here says under 5,000 is considered unavailable.
It is right now.
Yeah. Okay, but that could be changed if you had.
So the proposal would be to, instead of saying that anything under 5,000 is not available, has no capacity, to say if it's platted within the last decade or two,
okay,
we will put in its own bin and assume like one unit per lot.
Okay.
In doing our analysis on this, we started in 2007, and there were 2,000 vacant platted lots sitting on the table, and that was the peak of the boom.
Right.
All those are built now.
Okay, so this is a very small number we're talking about then.
2,000 units is a lot. There's not a lot of land.
Yeah. 2,000 units now?
There were 2,000 of these plotted vacant lots sitting on the table in 2007. It was the peak of the world.
Right.
And those have since all developed.
Okay.
Like 85% of those converted to houses now.
2,000, you said?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm a little concerned about including these in the available land because it's very short-sighted. In most situations, I think, you know, during the recession, that wasn't the case. There was 2,000 lots on there. But what I'm worried is the thing that's good to have is how do we use it in planning? If we're using it to say that that we have more land available than we actually do, then we want to add more area. It may be too short sighted, but because by the time that we get to, we're going to be doing these projections now, by the time it gets adopted by the council, this land, they probably have building permits on. And probably not available anymore. So just from the county's data, over the last, I think, 10 years, there were 7,000 land divisions and 10,600 permits pulled. So it kind of says that 2,000 deficit, that's where it went. So it's in there. We're kind of running probably even now. So as we're creating them, they're getting absorbed. And if we count that gap in there, we may underreport the land actually is really available. So.
Okay. Just pick up on that really quick. So I think, Eric, the point that you're raising is that we need to sync up the timing of when something is flagged as built or vacant with the timing of when we are looking ahead to the population projections. Because if the billable lands inventory gets fixed, and then 2 years later you make your population projection, you're right, probably a lot of those are in the rear view. So I think that's a timing issue that we've talked about with staff, and
we'll take a closer look at that. I think the idea would be that if the model results are based on assessor's data that is as close as possible to when the population projection is looking forward from, then you minimize that issue. It doesn't totally go away, and so maybe you have to account for that gap a little bit. But if you try to sync them up as much as possible, most of that land is still ahead of you, not behind you.
I agree that you need to deal with the lag you're talking about, but that's a toward the end of the process you deal with. One to say about the 5,000 square foot lots, you can guess by my whiskers, I've been doing this since 92, and I'll have to say that lots under 5,000 were not created or other than in very old plats. So if you have a subdivision of 3,000 square foot lot townhouse units, obviously they're built with lots. But at the same time, I don't know if you're distinguishing just platted lots, but the assessor's maps are flooded with gaps and slivers and 5,000 feet, that's 500 feet by 10 feet, and obviously you have to exclude all that kind of garbage.
Which does put us into two questions. Let's take the platted ones off the table because we know they're going to develop. Then you're left with the ones that aren't platted. But then you're going to do those.
Right. You need to set a time period. We didn't, I mean, it's been since hardly 2007 that we've been really platting some small lots.
Yes. And one of the challenges of saying we want to pull out platted lots is a platted lot has to have a date threshold. Right? How far back do you go with that before those plats start making sense on the lot?
Right.
I think we, at least in Vancouver, are seeing a lot of development subdivisions to smaller than 5,000 square foot lots. So I think it's appropriate to include them for a platted period. I don't know what's appropriate. We seem to be using 20 or 8 years for a lot here. I don't know how long-standing vacant lots, how quickly they develop. I guess there's also a question about, for really any of these, as we look at the recommendations sort of we're thinking and talking about, because that's what we know about what the current market is and what the current data says. Any advice you could give us on how we future cast, because obviously we're talking about the next 20 years, not the past 20 years. As you provide your individual recommendations and analyses, it would be useful to see if you would sort of say, here's what we think it is now based on the data, and we think it will increase a lot or decrease a lot, or increase a little or increase a little going forward.
Any other comments on this issue, David?
So, to play on off of Brian's question or comment, to play off of Brian's comment, one of the things that I was looking at with your exhibit two, I'm wondering if there's a breakdown by year. So are some of these, you know, if we have a 2007 to 2019 and we take a look at this across the lot sizes, is there a difference between what was happening in 2007 and 2019? For instance, is there a different trend now in what the county, what's happening in the cities and counties in terms of development of those size lots? Because you, for instance, you have, it's most likely to be 0 to 10,000 square foot lots, is the most likely to convert. Is that back, you know, in 2007? And are there more now? I'm just wondering if there's a trend as opposed to an overall average.
Talking about this one with the lot size or exhibit two with the value?
The two with the value.
I'll have to follow up with Bob on this, but I'm not 100% sure we can do that.
Okay.
With the data we have, without a lot more effort.
Yeah, so look at this more. I think if the committee says look at this more, we can get back to, again, separating out the platted ones and what happens to those, and then what's the remainder, and what's really happening with the ones that weren't platted.
we're kind of looking at the law there. If you want us to look at it more, awesome. You can look at it.
Can I just clarify the thing that you think would be helpful? You were saying on Exhibit 2, which is the building value, how much converted at different building value per acre threshold, is that right?
Yes.
And you are curious whether the one, whether there's a difference if we look back sort of over the past 10 years in the value of the, for the building value per acre of what's developed.
Yes, so basically our parcels with higher BVAs more likely to convert in 2018 than in 2007. Because that would show, because we have higher values now, obviously. I mean, there's been a huge increase in the value, either both assessed and fair market value. So that was sort of, is it gonna keep going in that trend, as Brian said?
And the data, again, Bob, will correct me if I'm wrong here, the building value per acre that is represented any place where we talk about building value in the charts that we have is the value as of 2007, correct? So it's a little bit confusing because it's a lot might have built at any time between 2007 and 2019, but what we're looking at is what was it worth as of 2007. So we just have sort of a snapshot. What was it in 07? What was it in 19? We don't know exactly when the transition happened and what the value was at that moment. So that's why I think it would take a different type of analysis to answer your question, and we'll see if we can get at that. I think it's an interesting question. And it would help us nail down a threshold potentially, but that is going to ebb and flow in market cycle, right? The thing that you can afford to build on in a hot market are different from the things you can afford to build on in a cool market.
I agree, but sometimes you might, instead of just, you know, noise in the data based upon the economic upturns and downturns, there can be an overall trend.
Yes.
And you have to realize, between 2008-ish and 2013-ish, nothing happened.
Right.
Nothing. So
yeah.
If you want to look at a trend in there, you're going to see nothing. There's nothing happened.
Right. I understand.
Striking when you look at the data.
Okay.
Yeah, if I may be so bold, I'm okay with the preliminary recommendations, but I do want to make sure that you guys are coming back to us with some additional data. Again, it's related to this zoning question as to what is that break point that tends to lend itself to more redevelopment on these, you know, half acre to acre size lots. My assumption is it's going to be something in the MF range, not, you know, the R12.
Okay. So with that, we've had a couple people say they think this is at least worthy of additional analysis. So that the committee's reference that we do some additional analysis and then come back at the next meeting. I see nods around the table, so we will do that for you.
To make sure and capturing what we're bringing back. I think what we heard was on the platted lot question, the thing we need to resolve is how far back are we looking when we say something is recently platted? Is that 10 years, longer? So that's the thing that we need to resolve is what's that cutoff going to be of plat date? But I heard general support for the concept, and then the other question was how closely are we going to be able to align the timing of fixing the land base with the timing of the population projection? And so that's another thing that we'll bring back.
To clarify that one real quick, I think it's great information to have. I guess my concern is that it throws off kind of the baseline. So if we're using this information and comparing it to what we had before, it may over-report the available lines because we didn't count it before. And we had a lot of lots that were platted that before we were considering those built because they were going to have homes on them. And if we add them in now, it's adding all this new land and it throws off our baseline in comparison. So I'd say if we do that, it's great data to have. So we have to be careful how we use it to make recommendations.
And I guess the other point I'd make about that is that we're not throwing the land in, so we're not counting additional land. We're looking at counting the units, or we're subtracting the units. So it's still I get your point.
Units.
Yes, whole population.
Capacity.
Yep,
capacity.
Okay, and then on the second part, which was the switch from building value to building value per acre, I heard some interest in a little bit more teasing out and asking the question, how much harder is it to be more complicated? So I think that's one that we need to kind of internally talk through a little bit more and see what we can bring. But that one I think will resurface at the next meeting with some the best additional information we can bring on it. And then on the third one, which was the small underutilized, I think what we heard was, in concept, yes, but we need to really think about that. How much is our capacity? What's the threshold of, how many additional units or something like that, that we need to dial that part in. So is that a fair way to capture what we're doing?
Yeah, I would just be interested in one more thing related to this. The issue of scale that I raised and the simplicity thing is it would be good to know how many what the acreage is of these larger lots that presumably get underestimated if we give them the same underutilized treatment as we do the smaller ones. So I don't know what the cutoff would be. It might be, I don't know, 5 acre lots or more. They'll obviously represent a pretty substantial minority of the total lots, but obviously we're looking at acreage. So I'm interested in what that is.
Any other comments on the residential part? If we'll move on to the commercial.
Okay, so on commercial and industrial land, the level of analysis we're able to do for residential, we've been able to do quite the same level for commercial and industrial just because of limitations in the data and the way that it is set up, that it's hard to use the data we have to inform the specific thresholds because it's not structured quite the same way as it is with a baseline model. But what we saw, looking at trends in this chart is showing where commercial land converted, what the classification was of the commercial land that converted between 2007 and 2019. And again, for purposes of commercial, when we say converted, we mean it had a building on it that was built since 2005. So that might mean it was redeveloped, it might mean it has a new building on it. So what we see is that the biggest chunk is in the vacant category, but there is a decent sized chunk over here in built as well. And right now, what the model is doing is assuming that nothing happens on the built land. So it means that this orange bar here is being missed right now by the model, the one that is at the top of the built bar. And then we also can see that the underutilized, it's actually a pretty small amount of that that's converted, and that's a little bit confusing too. So it suggests that maybe the way that the model is differentiating between built and underutilized is not really picking up the land that has that potential to convert. The other thing we don't know here, it's important to acknowledge, is we don't know if the things with a newer year built added jobs, added square feet. We don't really know that they increased capacity. It's a little harder to track that on the commercial side than on residential, where we can say, does it have more units? So that's a limitation as well. What we can tell is that the built land is getting new buildings built on it. That could be just, it's got a shopping center and they built one new thing here, or they tore down this building and built one new thing there. That could be what's going on. It's a little bit hard to tell from the data we have. We know that the built is right now seeing more sort of turnover, if you will, and conversion to newer buildings than the underutilized. And on industrial, we can see a little bit of the same thing. This chart's a little hard to read. But what you can see is that there's a lot of the land that converted is in the vacant category. That's great. That makes sense. There's some in some of these other port properties, et cetera. But again, you see a kind of decent little sliver in the built category that's bigger than what you're seeing in the underutilized. And so again, just raises the question, is the way that built and underutilized, or is the line between built and underutilized the right thing? Should we be picking up more of what's in that built bar? And the way that it's working right now, the building, the vacant threshold is a building value, it's a dollar value like the residential. Hasn't been updated in a while, doesn't vary by size. And so this one, again, the preliminary recommendation, this one, you know, we don't have a lot of evidence one way or the other on this. It was just, you know, maybe we could try the building value per acre. We need to figure out a way to set an appropriate threshold there because, again, the data we have right now doesn't really help us do that correctly. But that at least that would account for larger properties and it would update over time if we were to set it as a percentile instead of a fixed amount. And then on underutilized, it is expressed as building value per acre, but it's fixed at $50,000, whereas on the residential side, it's 10 percentile. So the recommendation would be just to, so that it would sort of trend over time, to take that or refine that and convert it to a percentile so that it would move over time as building values move. And that's really all we have on the commercial and industrial side. Again, it was a little bit, there's a little less that we can do with the data, the less certainty we have about what's happening. So the question to you all is, do you think that those refinements are worth doing? Is there additional analysis we need to bring other than we need to kind of dial in these thresholds if we're going to make a change? But do you think overall that these would improve?
So I think it's really important for us to have some way of ground truthing some of this stuff. We can work with the initial assumption, but then I think we have to go to some places that we would all agree as far as recognizing that they're built or they're underutilized in some fashion. Just thinking about it in terms of on the commercial side, is the Westfield Mall underutilized? Is a place that has most of the storefronts boarded up, but the building value remains the same. Is it underutilized? I think we have to try and drive a different form of analysis than just building values. Lots of industries will end up bringing in new equipment. The building itself, the rooftop doesn't change, the parking lot size doesn't change. How is that worked out in the assessment? So I think I could say, yeah, let's say that this is a method worth looking at, but I think we have to have some sort of ground truthing with it.
I'm going to have to agree with Vaughn on that. One of the tools that I've sort of been missed over time is the ground proofing, particularly in the commercial and industrial, with these value thresholds. There are a lot of property out there are fully utilized, industrial and commercial, with almost no building value because they don't need buildings. They're asphalt plants, they're ultra block, they're truck storage areas that serve important commercial industrial purposes, but they show up as vacant or underutilized because they don't have big buildings up. There isn't really any way outside of ground proofing and looking at photos or trying to make some determination subjectively whether that's true or not.
Yeah.
So just to pile onto that, so how would the model currently treat something like the BNSF rail yard over here, which is massive? It has no buildings on it, or very few buildings.
I believe they're excluded because of the outdoor.
Okay. So there may be similar types of industrial uses, outdoor storage, lay-down space, fabrication areas, and so on. That
The original model of underutilized, or the commercial, actually says if the assessor considers you a site and groups some parcels together, you actually just threw all those out. You said you're assessed together, we're throwing you out. So a lot of those you get
thrown out as if it's
built. I think another thing to point out, we have that beautiful histogram in residential. If you want that building value per acre, and you look at the histogram of building value per acre for commercial, there is none. It's just kind of bounces along, and there's a ton of them piled up by the So I think your statements are approved, but we still have to use the data that we can get at to visual things, not something the model's going to do.
And unfortunately, what we're really interested in here is inflated capacity, and there's no data set that's publicly available to look at what change in climate capacity can be what happens on this land. And to Jerry's point, he's exactly right. That there's all kinds of uses that are associated with commercial industrial uses that have lower no value that are absolutely essential for those functions, those businesses to function. That's a thing. Try and tease out a little bit more of every acknowledge that there's a challenge for this.
Pass the conch to David.
So, my first question is you, when I read through all of your reports, it seems that you believe that it's best to switch to this BVA from any particular one. Is that, I mean, that seems to be the recommendation. Bob Schicking has said no.
No, I think what we're saying, when we look at commercial, we have these values we set back in 2000. Are those reasonable today? How do they, one of the challenges we face, we have these meetings every decade. And we set these values, and sometimes the values moved independently of getting together every decade. That works well in residential. I think we're saying we're asking you guys what wants to do with commercial things.
So it seems to me it would be appropriate for the model to be consistent all the way through in terms of using one set of values. I think that would be appropriate. I mean, when I read through everything that you were producing, it seemed that that was appropriate. I think that where the difference is, and what I think where my question is what is the appropriate BVA? You know, I look at, I go to Portland a lot because that's where my office is, and I see a lot of development in Portland that's changed from buildings that, you know, could be now worth a lot more in terms of BVA, and they're completely torn down, and new commercial development goes up, lots of mixed use, lots of retail and some industrial, especially, you know, you look at the Pearl District especially. So I sometimes wonder what is the tear down cost versus the build cost, and how is that going to be built into how we pick the BVA? That's my question. I don't know the answer.
I agree. And, you know, I was a big proponent of this coming in, that let's switch everything to one scale. And I just said, well, let's look at the histogram for commercial. And I'm like, there is no histogram. Whereas you look at the histogram for residential, and it's just a perfect bell curve. And there's actually a natural break right at 10%. It's like, that's perfect. Mm-hmm. It works on the map. And I get to commercial, and I'm like,
it's not a histogram. So if it's not a good measure, I'm not sure what we do. We'll just talk that issue. It doesn't move. It may not even be a good measure. So, and
again, how hard is this to implement
in the model? I think that may be questions that I don't have the answer to here, Bob.
Those are questions we're looking at.
Yeah, well, just piggybacking on that point, too, and what Ron was talking about earlier. Is there a way to adjust some of the subjectivity that goes into that? Like, Ron had brought up length of the wall property. Is that under you? Like, I mean, that's a huge conversation. But, you know, how do you incorporate that in the model? I guess that's what my question is. If we're going to entertain that part, what's the standard to actually address that subjectivity?
I think we say it's employment, but we can't measure employment.
Eric. Yeah. So these charts are great, and to echo what you just said, they don't correlate though. So what we're seeing is the underutilized land in here is not converted, and some of the stuff that's built is. So right now we're kind of canceling out, but it's, you know, commercial, industrial, it's always a special situation. You can't really treat it like residential. And a lot of times it may be just the opposite of that, where areas that have higher value, that have a better built life, they're more likely to expand and create more jobs on stuff that we consider built than stuff that's just garbage that probably shouldn't be in our model. It's underutilized, it's in a bad location, there's no utilities. So I don't know what the answer is, but it, from the data we're having, what we're doing right now isn't really accurate. So I have to figure something out, let you know, but I think we're in the same spot. So.
Yeah, I haven't heard anything that tells me whether the current designations of land being residential versus commercial or industrial, whether that's assumed to be static. And I raise that issue because if you go to Portland, for example, you see apartment blocks being built in the middle of what were formerly commercial. Yeah, and what does that do to the model? Because, as you said, the value breaker for the building value breaker for commercial doesn't fit the same model as the residentials.
So that's an issue with mixed use that we'll be bringing to the committee in a future meeting.
It is
absolutely something that we'll be looking into and talking about.
So I did say earlier the concept of going out and doing some ground truthing. It seems like if we're going to make some headway on this, we have to have something that's more empirical that we can relate to rather than just throwing out a bunch of different ideas. The impact of this is almost, and I think Eric said something along that line, is the idea that sometimes when successful industries are set, they're going to just stay in their campus and they're going to continue to build and build and build and ramp up their business within the confines of that existing facility. We don't have really good data on being able to say that, you know, that's the case right now. But if we look at already what's happened with the Hewlett Packard facility and the whole campus that was involved with that and how that's morphed and changed, I think we have to be able to go back from what we had before and look at some of that and look at it now. If this comes down to anything else, I think from this group, we need to be giving some sort of recommendation to the county about some way of counting jobs. Because I'm hearing it come up repeatedly, and it seems like it's one of the things that is a really a big miss for us right now. Everything else is somewhat anecdotal as far as who's doing well and who isn't. But commercial property reinvents itself all the time. And the building shell might stay the same.
That's right.
Just to respond to that really quickly, I think this is going to pretty quickly tie back to our employment capacity discussion, and so I think this is something we'll kind of huddle up following this meeting, not immediately following, but sometime after this meeting, and figure out, because I think there is a real relationship, because what we're trying to get to is jobs. And so trying to figure out what's the best way to figure out how many new acres of employment land do we need to accommodate this many new jobs? That's really the basic question we're trying to answer. There's a lot of steps in between, but I think we need to kind of look at that overall picture together because it's a little less clear cut on jobs than it is on housing, because things can change over time and because not everything that accommodates employment has buildings on it at all. So I think that we'll talk about kind of if there's a different way we can bring this conversation forward that helps bridge those two issues.
Kind of underlying that, I mean, not all jobs are the same. And so we have a number of our cities who are really grappling with it. As a company wants to come to town and is looking for a particular incentive or even a Main Street store improvement type incentive. I know Ridgefield has been looking at metrics and indicators for how to value a new employer's arrival. And what that means in jobs, certainly we saw that distilled a little bit in the HP development agreement through the City of Vancouver. So I think we could pull together some of our city leaders in that evaluation process, and if there's objective criteria that on a national level for comparable sized or comparably developing cities, that could be useful.
Let's hear from Mary and Jeff, and then we'll wrap up this agenda item.
I just want to make a point on capacity because that's really what we're trying to measure. And if you're replacing an Ultrabot that has five jobs per acre, with a new building that has 9 jobs per acre. But I think in our models, we're treating the new building as 9 jobs per acre, ignoring the jobs that were already on the underutilized, and or vacant, certainly in vacant, if it's called vacant, like an asphalt plant or an ultra block. We're taking out those jobs and creating 9 new ones, but we lost the original ones.
I think comparatively, residential is pretty easy to model compared to commercial industrial. I mean, we've been grappling with employment plan studies and stuff for a number of years around here. And you know, industrial, you're looking for a parcel that can yield a pad, an industrial pad that works. And we have a lot of parcels in the county zone industrial that have critical areas that bisect the parcel, and so you can't get a viable pad and therefore a viable industrial use, and so they just tend to sit and languish. I think similarly for commercial, you'll find commercial land throughout the county, but when a site selector comes in, they'd rather pick up something that's built and redevelop it than go to an area that has commercial zoning but doesn't have good access and exposure for commercial uses. So we have some of these pieces out there that just, you know, is the zoning designation on it highest and best for where it's located. How do other jurisdictions look at modeling this issue for industrial commercial land? Can we look into that?
Use employee per acre figures that are based off of employment security data, which has been unavailable for more than half a decade now. And there are some variations in how other counties do, and there's some documentation for that in the memo. What I'm taking away from this conversation is we have some work to do that that the committee is somewhat skeptical that building value per acre is actually a better metric than a value, that we need to do some ground truthing on this. The constraints may be another factor that we can look at and build into our assessment. And so we're going to need to, as Becky said, and do some thinking about what we can do with the limited data that we have. And this may be an instance where there's no ideal solution to get to, and you have to choose the best solution, which may not be a great solution for the county, because of all the factors that there were. We've been through this in other jurisdictions and had people who were incredulous that there was not some empirical model that could drop data into that would tell you if something will develop or redevelop. And the answer is somebody would make a lot of money if they can figure out how that works. And it's not simply because there's so many exceptions to the rules. It's the stuff that Eric talked about is exactly the case.
Right. Well, models are abstractions, and what we're trying to do is not create something that's perfect, but create something that's better than what we got, right? So let's not make perfect the enemy of good enough.
We'll let Brian have the last word on this.
I'll make it quick, but it's just, I mean, hopefully it's a little bit of comfort. For what it's worth, when we looked at the overall performance of the model in the past, its output on jobs, and track that with how the capacity estimates in the VBLM model went down, it wasn't that bad. I forget what the numbers are, I'll relook at them, but it seemed reasonable. Residential is another story, but on the job side, it didn't seem too bad. Now, that tracking of state reported jobs, of course, is covered wages, so it doesn't include jobs that have been, I don't know what percentage that would be ever in the past, maybe 10% of jobs, is that right, that are not?
It's probably closer to 20.
20? Okay, so maybe there's something there, but at least in covered wage reporting, the model is tracking reasonably well.
Okay. So last one is a short one, so it's not really vacation, but short. This is the off-model redevelopment assumption. So right now, as I mentioned before, 5% of population employment growth, when the demand projections are done, is assumed to happen through redevelopment that's not otherwise captured in the model. And so there's two things here. One is a little confusing to have an off-model thing happening
especially when you're trying to dial in your assumptions in the model. So that's just a sort of possible source of confusion. And then the other issue is that the new legislation is kind of into showing your work. And, you know, there's a lot of things in the current model that are like, you know, reasonable-ish assumptions that other jurisdictions sometimes use, but that don't have a real solid empirical base to them because, you know, it's like, well, that seems about right. And that's not to say they're wrong, but they're, you know, there's a little more emphasis on showing your work. So the issue that we have here, as I mentioned before, is that you're never going to be able to predict all of the development that's going to happen. So there are going to be things like zone changes, or we might decide that things like ADUs and cottage clusters are like, yeah, there's going to be a sprinkle of those. We don't know where, and we don't really care. It might be easier to just say some percentage of our growth has and will occur on land that we're not going to specifically identify for development, but it's just going to happen somewhere that we didn't anticipate. So this would be sort of a catch-all for, like, how much stuff do we historically miss on our built land, on zone changes, et cetera? And that might be one way to look at it. It's just to say, okay, how much of, we could look back and try to estimate how much has happened. So our thought at this point is not to entirely eliminate this kind of off-model assumption, but to try to use it as, like, refine the things where we think, like, we can identify the land on which this will happen and capture that in the model, and then say, okay, what's left? If we were to rerun what's happened with all those assumptions, what would we still be missing? And then consider baking those in as, like, this is the stuff that, like, we don't really know where it's going to happen. We just know historically it has. That's all there is to this recommendation. It would obviously need some more work to figure it out, but I think the question for you at this point is, does that feel like at a high level the right approach versus trying to get all of the capacity accounted for inside of the model?
So one way to think about that is, we've struggled with this with a lot of jurisdictions for decades. If it's done inside the model, you're thinking about doing it from a supply perspective. You're looking at the attributes of the individual piece of the property and saying, do these attributes suggest that it's going to develop? The one thing you don't want to do is put that on the map because individual property owners might have disagreements about what their intention with properties are. We did a survey in Oregon a few years ago and found out that only 10% of the cities were monitoring redevelopment, and the ones that were all under 1,000 people. And our conclusion was there's just not enough happening in those places for them to support a big amount of effort to really understand what's happening on in the redevelopment space. So on the outside of the model, I can think about that as just saying we assume some amount of capacity is going to be going to occur on redevelopment lands, and it doesn't have to be the same for employment versus residential, but right now I think the model treats it the same on both sides. So, Dan.
I'll let Jamie go first.
No, I'll let Mr. Jackson.
I don't have an issue with this concept in general, but one of the things that I'm wondering, and the question that I would ask for you to look at is there a way to say more of this redevelopment activity is happening, and probably more of it will happen because of just the nature of the development that's going on now in our area. I mean, for example, the strip mall that was down here off of on Mill Lane 15, you know, it's gone on, and some buildings going up. I don't know what it is. Some of the people here at the table might. But we're having more and more, from my view, just anecdotally, of a lot of redevelopment. So the question is the 5% number appropriate? Is it going to be larger? We now, when we had the 5% number, we didn't have ADUs, we didn't have cottages. So should there be a difference in the number? I don't know the answer. It's just something that I would put to you to maybe look at and see if there's some response.
So my initial response to that is other jurisdictions we have worked with have done that. Policy can influence the amount of redevelopment that occurs.
So that I wouldn't say that's off the table for discussion of market room. Exactly what that looks like. It would be presumably something that's less of something that we can't afford wanting to encourage building development over the planning horizon. Jamie.
So my point of view on this is that I think it finds equilibrium with this redevelopment percentage versus like the assumed capacity of vacant land, the land vacant sites here. It's, for instance, you have a 40-acre parcel, the zoning says X. My experience in doing hundreds and hundreds of lots out there, usually the property never develops towards that maximum allowable unit count. It's something, you know, typically a percentage off from that. And because of that, I think the flip side is also true, however, that sometimes you get extra growth on redevelopment parcels that may not be accounted for. That tends to find its equilibrium. So I would be a little bit cautious on moving this to a strict percentage basis for that.
Right.
A couple things. I'll just try to talk about it. I think in Vancouver now we have about 6,000 multifamily units at various stages of the approval process, from pre-app to finalization. And just eyeballing that list, and I think I included an earlier version of that list in my comments in back in December, so if anyone wants to look at it there. But eyeballing that list, and that's just multifamily, not redevelopment, single family, which probably is wrong that much. A fair number, a minority, but still a fair number of those apartments and the units involved are on lands that have had some sort of building. Either they show a demolition relatively recently, or there's something else there now. Many of them are zoned commercial. So I think I don't know what approach is best. I would just encourage us to have enough time in the schedule to address it properly. And I guess I wouldn't lose. It sounds like most of the other comparator jurisdictions do some. Correct me if I'm wrong. Do some sort of parcel-based analysis. So it would be interesting from that what level of aggregate redevelopment does that result in. And I think it's fair to say that yes, you do run into some problems if you have a visible map saying these are that properties. But you can have a different map. You can have a map that says this is just for coming up with an aggregate estimate. You know, there's ways of getting around the public-facing aspect of that. So I wouldn't totally move away from the land-based approach if it's possible. I think in the number, it probably is, who knows what's appropriate, but it's probably going to be pretty large, especially since we're moving forward relative to what we've been in the past. Clark County as a whole is the second densest population per square mile in the state, and if you take away Vancouver, if there was like a Vexit, you'd still have, they'd go to four. So there's land is to some extent running out, so I think we're going to probably see a lot more in the future. I don't know how much.
So to your first point, other counties have done those kinds of studies, and it's much easier to do with housing than it is with employment.
Yeah, I'm talking mostly about housing.
Yes. Yeah, it's absolutely possible to look back and say what percentage of units went on the properties that were identified as built in the model, and how what's the delta on that, and use that to inform an assumption moving forward. The second point on it that I think you or somebody else brought up is the history may not be the appropriate indicator of the future, that things change, and that might be a consideration that the committee wants to take up in their conversation.
Eric. So kind of like a bigger view. I know we're with the legislation, we're charged with getting to show work. At the same time, we can spend a lot of time trying to fix things that aren't really broken in the model. And if we can look at like this right here, this is the best information we have. We don't have the drafting. We've kind of heard that. I don't know if this is something that's really broken in the model.
and that we're trying to work out the best information. So we show our work that, you know, we analyzed it, we looked at what the options were, and this is still the best option we have, instead of, you know, wasting a lot of resources on it. If you look at what, why this came about, I think it was, you know, a few things. One, it was, you know, available industrial and jobs land for certain situations, and it was also affordable housing. And that's really a concern, that we have the shortage of land for housing, and it's driving prices up. So that's the real thing that caused this, the legislation. So focusing on that, and we're going to run into these things. So I guess I encourage the group, sometimes we're going to just have to say, this is the best information we have, and not try to fix something that's not really broken.
And for all of these options, keeping the model as it is an option that's on the table for you.
I was going to say, we do need to move to public comment, make sure we have time for that, and then the last thing on the public comment is just a quick preview of what's coming at the next meeting. This beautiful Friday afternoon, do not want to keep y'all late, so I think we'll go with the last comment on this, and we'll go to public comment, and then
Ari, I have a couple of questions. My group has submitted a number of comments, and we'd like to have the consultants indicate which of those comments you're going to react to, or how you're going to react to those. And then secondly, and we want to make sure that all the comments that have been submitted get into the record, and that this group sees those comments. And then the other questions I have, and it may be premature, but what I'm going to be looking for in this process is, how is the land along the Slashy Railroad going to be treated in terms of development potential? And secondly, I didn't see any discussion here about the rural centers and how the rural centers can be included in this development process.
I think you should just quickly restate, because I didn't catch
it.
You wanted to see how the land along
the Slashy Railroad.
And the rural centers, we will come back to as part of the rural capacity discussion.
Right. So the comments that were submitted to that weren't submitted to me, but were submitted to council or county manager, we're going to be working on to get and make that available to the committee.
There's some in the record.
Yes, but there's some additional comments that aren't in the record yet. Make sure that you guys are aware.
Are
there any
public comments? Okay.
In keeping with that, if you want your comments to be in the record of these proceedings, submit them to Jose or email them to Sonia. Sending them to the counselors, even all five of the counselors, just adds more steps before those things get to planning and get into the record of this group. So it does matter where you send stuff.
Yeah, so we'll take public comment up here. 3 minutes per person. I will hold something up at you when you're at like 10 seconds to go as a little reminder.
Carol Lebanon from Clark County Citizens United. As a response to this comment that was just made, I think that the initial information that was coming from this consulting firm said that the information was going directly to the council. So we will definitely make changes, because we probably have about 30 documents of data that we have found that we believe that this committee needs to review. Also, we found that also there's an AHBL consulting firm that's also involved in this, and we're just wondering who those folks are. And some other stakeholders, there's no names, we're wondering who those stakeholders are. So if someone could answer those questions, we appreciate that. I've also submitted a 1995-1999 July 2000 Clark County Monitoring Report, and we went through this and we determined that in the rural areas, there's probably about 3,000 lots left. That won't last for 20 years. So I think this is a very important data. The reason it's important is because of the fact that it says that that's all there is. In 2000, there was 13,000 something lots. That's including what's there and what's potential. So after 20 years, those are gone. So that's very important to the rural folks. And then also the rural element in the WAC 365, 196, 425, very descriptive over what has to happen when you plan for a county's population projection and for what needs to happen. So we'd like you also, I've submitted both of these documents for the committee to be able to review. Thank you.
Any other public comments? Okay. Final thing on the agenda is just a quick look ahead to our next meeting. So next meeting, there are a couple things that we will bring back to you. We will bring back as much as we can of the additional information that we talked about today at the next meeting. Some of it may need to be the following meeting, depending on how much work it is. But we'll bring back as much as we can at the next meeting. And then we're also going to introduce two new pieces of this, which are market factor and infrastructure gaps. So on the market factor side, we talked about this a little bit, but this is another one where there are existing assumptions. They may not be wrong, but there's a little more emphasis on showing the work now. And so we're trying to figure out the best way to make sure that those are appropriate, that they are based on some sort of reasonable evidence base. It doesn't have to be perfect, but it has to be reasonable. So we'll hope to bring you some information for that for the next meeting. And then on the infrastructure gaps, this is another one responding to the new legislation. Making sure that if there are places that can't be served, that we identify those, so how those would be identified, and then also confirming how the urban holding areas, if we need to do any different or track differently what's in the urban holding versus not in the urban holding. So those are the type of topics we're going to bring back next time. Like this meeting, we'll be looking for direction and follow-ups that we need to address, that if there is anything that we're able to say, great, we nailed it, then we'll put a pin in that and move on. But that's our plan for next meeting. Is there anything that anybody wants to make sure on those topics? We have about 10 minutes left. If there's anything you want to make sure we bring to you or that you really want to know about those topics, this would be a good time to bring it up.
I would assume that it is anyway, but in terms of market factor, the extent you can have past data goes back 20 years, so we can see what has developed over the last 20 years in the past. So we could be doing that anyway.
Anything else? And on the data, I hope so.
Can we strive to get the information out and available to us sooner than the day before the meeting?
Yeah.
You should have had the packet available a week prior, last Friday.
It was recent.
Yeah.
You only had a day left.
Okay.
But we had it. Yeah.
The only thing I sent out yesterday was the PowerPoint and an additional comment, but we sent a link out a week ago with all the other information.
And in general, the packet, any memo types of things will be up on the website a week prior. So late on your Friday afternoon, a week before your meeting, go check it out if you haven't heard from Jose yet, but you should. You'll generally hear from Jose, and we'll definitely be out there.
So happy hour meeting.
Okay. And if you don't get it, please, make sure you do. Thanks for spending this Sunday Friday afternoon with us, and It's a really good discussion. I appreciate your comments and contributions.
Move to adjourn.
Second.